In her book, The Secret Garden, Frances Hodgkin Burnett writes, "If you look the right way, you can see that the whole world is a garden. That thought leads us to ask, how should we tend our earthly garden?"
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1243rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Montevideo who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, when it gets right down to it, we've been most atomistic with respect to how we have tended our earthly garden. The single element we have focused on is profit, which is simply the difference between what something costs and what it can be sold for. Now, some say profit is a dirty word, but really, profit is the energy that enables us to have families, communities, nations, and even civilizations. Without profit, we are not. That said, our single-minded pursuit of profit has led us to exploit our garden in ways that are, sometimes, downright harmful. To generate profit, we sometimes take from the garden without giving in return. But as we continue to take without giving in return, our garden is diminished and has less and less to offer our future. This thought leads us to ask, how should we tend our earthly garden? Here to help us dig for some answers, we have Judith Schwartz, who is the author of The Rainbow Reindeer Chronicles and Cows Save the Planet. Judith, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you.
Judith, how did a Columbia School of Journalism graduate come to write about cows saving the planet?
Well, that's kind of a long story in that it took a long time for me to kind of get with what was happening here on the land. But I moved to Vermont, and if, interesting, you started with profit. If I could say any kind of moment that my work and my thinking took a new direction, it was living in a small town, which led me to have the awareness of every local purchase that I make matters. And that tiny, tiny insight kind of changed everything. So that led to an exploration of economics about challenges I saw in our economic model, such as, you know, you talk about taking without giving back, that nature is not considered in the GDP, in our measurement of how our economy is functioning. So things like that I found really fascinating. Also, like I said, living in a rural area, I was aware that money tended to flow out of the area into the money centers. And I started to explore that, and then, strangely enough, that led to soil. Because when you start to ask the question, well, what is wealth? Wealth is the soil. That is kind of our collective bank, and the plants that grow upon it, and the life that the soil and those plants support. So that's how I got there. But you're asking about cows and reindeer. So The Cows book is a book about soil, but I felt that I needed a kind of jazzier title other than something like soil is really important. You should care about that, because this is a few years ago when people weren't talking about soil as much as they are now. I am happy that they are. But at the time, when people were connecting the implications of soil for our healthy food systems and for addressing climate change, the people who were talking about that were ranchers who were engaged in holistic management. And
that's a big word.
It's a big word, and I can break that down for you. So basically, holistic management is a decision-making process that was developed and is often applied to the stewardship of grazing animals. So to get more specific, this was developed by someone named Alan Savory. And more people know who he is. He kind of got a little burst of fame because he did a TED Talk that has now been viewed more than 7 million times. So Alan Savory was a wildlife biologist in Zimbabwe. At that time, it was Rhodesia. And he loved wildlife. And I completely get it. My husband is from South Africa, and he wanted to be a game ranger when he grew up. I mean, just the sight of these huge herds of zebra and giraffe and wildebeest and all these wonderful creatures moving around is just intoxicating.
Moving over the land.
Exactly. Right. Not just kind of sitting there and looking pretty or ferocious, depending on the animal. Alan loved the landscape and the animals, and he observed that the land wasn't looking as good as it did when he was a child, you know, when he started going to college and becoming a game ranger. And he wanted to know why, and the animals weren't looking so healthy. So in the National Park Service where he was working, they decided that the reason was that there were too many animals for the landscape. So they blocked off certain areas. And then, rather than getting better, the landscape actually deteriorated. And so this puzzle motivated Alan for a long time. And he came to understand the interactions between animals and their landscapes and how, in many instances, the land needs the animals in the same way that the animals need the land. He saw the kind of landscape we're talking about is the African savanna. And grasslands like the African savanna or like our Great Plains co-evolved with grazing animals. And over time, Alan came to understand some of the dynamics. So you have the animals trampling in seeds, so you get a diversity of grasses. Their nibbling stimulates the growth of plants, it gets really detailed down to the saliva of the animals, and their waste fertilizes the soil, and their trampling also presses down dying plant matter so that it can be broken down by microorganisms and kind of become a part of the soil. So, that doesn't sound very romantic. You know, when you think about a healthy ecosystem, you think of all the things growing. You don't think about all the things that are dying. But all of this, all of the matter, all of the plant matter, all of the microbial matter, all of the animals themselves need it. There needs to be a cycle.
It's kind of like everything's eating everything and creating life.
Right, right. But it's not just an arrow one way. It's a cycle.
Yeah.
And so we neglect that at our peril, because one of the insights that he had was that sometimes land degrades because there's too much grazing on it, from overgrazing, but sometimes land degrades because there's not enough animal activity. And that's why when they took the animals off the land just kind of, was losing its vitality. So over time, he developed this method. The key point, which you alluded to, is that the animals must be kept on the move. Because basically, in nature, in natural ecosystems, plants are managed by animals who eat herbivores, animals that eat plants, and herbivores are managed by predators. But because how we've kind of divvied up the land, we've got roads,
put the fences up.
Exactly. All of this, our cities and roads all of our institutions, everything breaks up that, that flow of the animals. And so And also we have a decrease. We don't have as many predators in the landscape because, as it turns out, people in cities and farmers don't like, and ranchers don't like having these predators around when they're raising, say, sheep. So in the absence of predators and this predator-prey dynamic, humans, through their management, can take on the role of the ecological role of the predator and keep those animals on the move.
Now, I've seen practical applications of Alan Savory's great notion domestically in places like Joel Salatin's Polyface Farms, where he takes on the role of the predator and moves his animals, his chickens and his cattle and his pigs and whatnot, through the fields. And consequently, he has a rich abundance of grasslands on his farm, whereas the neighbor has not any grasslands on his farm. It's a real dramatic demonstration of that. Now, how does what you saw with Alan Savory come to life in the Reindeer Chronicles and the reindeer themselves?
Aha. Okay, so we're shifting. I will say that I have, because I've written two books. I also wrote a book called Water in Plain Sight, Hope for a Thirsty World, about how water intersects with climate, biodiversity, and peace and conflict, food security. And I went to a number of ranches there. And I point out that book because I did have the opportunity to spend 8 days with Alan Savory and his wife in Zimbabwe at the Africa Center for Holistic Management.
You just said that to make us all jealous, right?
I mean, I must say that that was a time when, you know, my husband was there, and after a full day of going on walks or visiting villages, and then the air cools and you hear the elephants and you can sit and you can watch the baboons and all the antelope around, you know, just in the cool of the evening drinking nice fresh white wine, you just think, like, am I really here? So that was quite quite amazing.
Before we went on air, I told Judith, I think you had way too much fun writing this book. And I think she does.
Yeah.
So, reindeer.
Yes. Okay. So, as it turns out, animals that you might not think of as being kind of vehicles for ecological change, which, depending on the context and the management, can be positive ecological change. You might not think of reindeer, but when I was traveling in Norway, I went to Norway a couple of years ago to speak at a conference on indigenous knowledge, and my topic was the global ecology of grazing. So I had all these examples from my reporting in Zimbabwe and in Mexico and across the U.S. But reindeer, I thought, okay, better study up.
Well, you're going to have to hold the reindeer story, Judith, because we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll pick up the reindeer story. And then we're going to go to busting some myths that you can find in the Reindeer Chronicles. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Judith Schwartz, who is the author of The Reindeer Chronicles, which is the focus of our conversation. Well, hopefully it will be after we come back from this break. Do stay tuned. We're going to talk about busting some myths with Judith Schwartz.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back, and we're talking reindeer, and we're talking the climate, and we're talking about how reindeer managed the climate with Judith Schwartz, the author of The Reindeer Chronicles. So how did they do that?
Yeah, so reindeer are managed by herders, such as the Sami people in the far north of Scandinavia and Russia.
They take the place of the predators, right?
No, they are the herbivores. They are managing the landscape.
I meant the herders took place as...
Oh, thank you. Yes. Yes, they did. So what the Sami herders do is they have winter grazing areas, which tend to be less where things don't freeze is actually, anyway, they're moving them across the landscape. And so, because they are, I stumbled myself because actually they are on snow and ice in the winter. So the reason that they are significant in terms of managing that far northern landscape is that they're, so when they eat brush in the summer, like shrubs, they are managing that, those plants, so that one, they don't grow because they are shrubs and larger plants as the region warms are kind of getting a foothold on the landscape, but the reindeer are keeping them in check. But also it's important because they, those shrubs are darker colored than the summer heath, which is a kind of more pale tannish color. And the reason that the color is important is that dark color has a lower albedo or reflectivity, so it absorbs heat. So snow reflects heat. If you want to keep the area cool, you want to keep snow on the ground, because once then you get the, you're down to the grass, then you start absorbing more heat. And then the other way is that the movement of their hoofs crushes the snow. And first you think, oh my goodness, you don't want us to crush that snow. But in fact, the snow was acting as an insulation. So it was keeping the ground underneath from freezing. But when they press down the snow, actually, that keeps the ground colder because it's the loss of insulation.
Right.
Yeah, so that's some of the dynamics so, with the reindeer.
So as you speak, I come to this understanding of holistic management as being one in which one looks at the whole and tries to figure out how all of the moving parts work together to achieve that whole. Am I wrong?
No, that's right. That when you began, you talked about how our profit model drives everything, but sometimes our profit model is only interested in taking and not thinking about the consequences. But in holistic management, you are always looking at the perhaps hidden consequences of any action. The other thing about holistic management as it is applied is that you always assume that you are wrong, because that takes off the pressure for being right, and that gives you room to make adjustments.
Wow.
So when I learned about how to actually make a plan, when I attended the new cowgirl camp in eastern Washington State,
which is where we're heading next.
Yes. Yeah, I learned more about how this is done, and the teacher, Beth Robinette, said that you make your plan in pencil, and you only write it in pen when you've already passed that, but you need that information for your records.
So you can always erase your original thought and put in a real thought.
Right, because you are managing complexity, and a rigid kind of prescribed plan just cannot allow, does not allow for the unforeseen changes that inevitably occur when you're dealing with agricultural systems, including managing animals.
Okay, with that, we're going to take the folks to that cowgirl camp. It was called the New Cowgirl Camp up in Washington State. And Judith Schwartz got on an airplane on the East Coast and flew all the way across America to go to a new cowgirl camp. Why?
Because I wanted to check it out. Because I'd been writing about these people, and I thought, okay, I want to see what I can do. I want to see this work from the inside. And also see it from a woman's point of view. I was curious. Well, I've been aware of the kind of ranching community for a while, and there are some brilliant young women who are taking to this work so naturally and making really profound connections between what how the animals' behavior and the landscape and how to work with them. And so I wanted a closer look.
You know, a quick parenthetical, if you will allow. It seems to me like cows and cattle are very, very politically incorrect in today's environmental movement. How do you respond to people who say, you're writing about cows?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it makes me really sad because I think it's a distraction from so many really important conversations we do have to have. And when I'm feeling a little bit snarky, I say it's really unfair of us to blame cattle for our failure to manage them appropriately.
Very good. That would be a Temple Grandin-ish thing to say, I would suspect.
Yeah.
You're at a new cowgirl camp and with a bunch of women, and you're learning how to be cowgirls, which would be very interesting to see. But let's go to I collected some of the quotes that you put on the table from the new cowgirl camp, some of which are very fascinating. Here's one. You can kill on a farm. It's more humane.
Yeah. You think about the animal's point of view, and you think about the trauma and confusion that an animal would have being put into a truck and taken to a new place, whereas when it's done on the farm, it's done lovingly. These animals, they're killing the animal, but the animal has had a good life. I've seen people's relationship with the animals, and it is, of course, hard to kill an animal, but it's also in the purpose of feeding the community good, healthy food. So as uncomfortable as it is, we need to look at that. So in other agricultural systems, there's a lot of death that we don't see. So, for example, with expansions of farming areas, often land is cleared, and then the animals that lived on that land and depended on it now have no place to go. So you've left these animals homeless. And certainly with the chemicals that are used in a lot of agriculture, in what's called conventional agriculture, there's a huge loss of life there, you know, from in the soil. The fungi and the earthworms and dung beetles and all of that, and all the microbes, and also above ground, the pollinators and the birds that eat the seeds. So I feel like we really need to be very honest and open and to honor the process of feeding ourselves.
Which, when it gets right down to it, means that you have to kill something, because living things have to kill to survive. And whether you're taking the life of an animal or a soybean plant or whatever, it's just a fact of life, unless I'm missing something somewhere.
No, I think that's it. And I guess the point I'm making is that soybean plant, that there was a lot of killing in the process of growing it.
Here's another quote. We are assembling an army of cowgirls to change the world.
Yes, well, that certainly is Beth Robinette's spirit. So Beth is very smart, and she's a very interesting young woman in that she grew up knowing holistic management because her father was one of the early adopters of holistic plant grazing in the Pacific Northwest. So this is very natural to her. So she has seen how you manage, she's learned since childhood, how do you work with animals? How does working with animals affect the land? How does the health of the land affect the people? And she just like owns these insights so deeply and feels so strongly that we, in the process of feeding our communities and our families healthy food, can also heal our landscapes. And ranches are large, so that's a lot of land.
Mm-hmm.
And so she means it. And I guess the other aspect is about women on the land is just the notion, which is, you know, nothing hard and fast about this, but exploring different styles that maybe women are socialized to listen more and therefore can have a different relationship with coworkers and with their communities and with the animals. But bringing feminine attributes and embracing those in the service of ranching.
One of the quotes kind of points that notion out. Beth says of her workshops, women seemed eager to learn, while the young men sort of felt like they need to show us what they already know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's putting it well. And, you know, I guess I'm feeling sort of funny because I have a lot of colleagues I like very much that are male ranchers, too. But I guess what to me was so exciting was that there was a group of young women who just felt that, okay, this is what I want to do. I'm not going to be intimidated by the fact that this is not a traditional women's occupation, and I can handle it. So for me, you know, I'm a generation older than them, and it would have been absolutely beyond my comprehension to get on a horse and move cattle. I mean, that would just be like, you know, every bit of strange is going to the moon. But this just, I just felt that the sense of possibility and the enthusiasm and the sense of sharing, it was really thrilling, actually.
And one of them that really touched me, because it kind of reminded me of an experience I had when I was studying Chinese at the University of California and spending hours in a language lab. And I'd stumble out of the language lab, and right next door was a biodynamic garden put together by Alan Chadwick. And it was always filled with attractive young women digging in the dirt. And I ran across this quote from Beth, I believe. Or maybe it was you. I'm pretty sure it was you. Many women I meet say they have always felt an elemental connection to the soil and how it grounds them.
Yes, that was me. And it is really fun to meet women and talk about soil because they're right, there is something ineffable about the connection, about how, I don't want to say empowered they feel, but just how affirmed and grounded. What can you say? I mean, it is grounding. You know, I had a story of a colleague who believed that her healing from a serious illness was greatly facilitated by working in a garden.
And she was doing so barefooted, was she not?
Yes, I think so.
And when I read that, I thought, yeah, barefoot in the garden. Wow. Now, Beth is leading these seminars, and she's teaching, and she says this. I'm getting over the idea of trying to convince people to change how they do things. It's better to give people who want to make a change the tools to get started.
Yeah, I think that's really, really powerful. And just, you know, it makes me think, if all the energy that people in the environmental and regenerative agriculture world, or, yeah, any world for that matter, spent, if all the energy used to try to convince other people that their way is right, if that was shifted towards welcoming people who are new to the field, that would just free up so much creative energy.
Well, hopefully it will. And if there's no sense in investing a lot of time and money and effort in something that does not want to go where you want to go, better to spend it on people who want to go where you want to go, and perhaps you have a much better chance of getting there. We just have a few moments left before we'd have to take another break, but something that Beth said that really struck me, and it is, I think it wasn't Beth, but it was somebody else. Perhaps, no, this was you, I think. A subject that has lurked unspoken, the unique problems faced by women ranchers. That is what I would like to pick up when we come back from this quick break. This is Michael Olson. I am the host of the Food Chain Radio program with author Judith Schwartz, The Reindeer Chronicles, and today we're talking about busting some myths of women in agriculture that she talked about in The Reindeer Chronicles. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, there it is. We are back. This is The Food Chain, talking about women in agriculture and how... When Judith looked into the whole notion of women in agriculture, she started finding lots of them enjoying doing work traditionally thought to be men's work. And one of the quotes I picked up in that story was, "A subject that has lurked unspoken, the unique problems facing women ranchers." What would those unique problems be, Judith?
Yeah, well, I guess what was interesting was that it lurked, that it wasn't the whole emphasis. It wasn't like, let's get together and gripe about this. You know, it wasn't that kind of thing, but it was something that lurked because it had to be addressed at some point. Well, yeah, so the challenges are that it's not considered typical for women to be ranchers. So many who are doing this work feel diminished as they go about their, engaging with other people in the agricultural community. So that can be frustrating. And so a few people shared some of their experiences that, let's say, one woman who had goats, and now she has cattle, actually, she was out with her husband, and when they were dealing with a situation with the animals, the person was always looking at her husband and not at her. So it was just diminishing. It's hard to be taken seriously. And Beth certainly found that, and certainly because she started so young, that if something positive happened, it would be attributed to her father's work, even if she knew that she was the one that implemented a particular strategy or something like that. So it's a matter of being taken seriously.
Well, I've had the opportunity in my life to work at a number of ranches, and most all of them had the traditional family, whereas the man did this kind of work and the women did that kind of work. But to me, it was always teamwork, and so never really differentiated so much myself. But if you don't have that traditional family set up, it might be a lot different, I suspect.
Right. That was another thing that people were talking about. So one woman in the group who had visited with a lot of different women ranchers found that those who didn't have partners or who had partners that weren't particularly supportive of or engaged in this work had a real struggle, and sometimes those relationships ended up breaking up. So that is a challenge, and that's something that Beth talks about openly because her partner is an English teacher. And as Beth says in her quotable way, ranching just isn't his jam. So, you know, part of her thinks, gosh, it would just be so much easier if I just found a guy that did this and we could just get so much more work done. But, you know, this is her guy. So
there it is.
Yeah.
Well, one of the young ladies said, it's super exciting to have women here who don't have partners involved.
Right. Because if starting a venture like a farm with livestock is challenging when you have a partner supporting you, or, you know, like you're mutually supporting each other, but they're there. It's even more challenging to do this on your own. But people were. I'm trying to think of the women that, you know, I've kept up with a number of them. And I know that one woman who has a wife, they have started a farm, and I see lovely photos on Instagram. And what she was able to do, I mean, this is another challenge, is access to land. Buy land in conjunction with her parents. So they invested together. So that's one person. And then another woman has a husband in a completely different field, but her excitement was enough to get him excited about animals, that they moved from their more urban area to a rural area and have a farm.
There you go. Living happily ever after. Couple things to kind of tie in the holistic land management here. The grasslands are not a tool to grow animals. The animals are a tool to grow grassland.
Yeah, I think that's
Alan
really
Savory at its best, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's what it is. That when you look at, it's all how you look at things, that if you look at the grasslands as something to take from, as to use, it's different from when you're focusing on the health of the land. Because when you're, all of your management is devoted and organized around the health of the land, then the results will be very positive and you'll have abundant, you know, produce or healthy animals.
But the profit margin may be less because you're giving while you take. If you just take without giving, your profit margin can be much better for a little while.
Exactly. It's the little while that's a key, because when you're working in that, you know, intense industrial model, you're also putting a lot of money into inputs as opposed to putting a lot of your effort into the ongoing resource, which is the health of the soil.
And then kind of to tie it up, we have the one that really struck me. A fence is a contract you are telling the animal. I will meet all your needs as long as you stay in the fence.
Yeah. Well,
that's the deal, right?
Yeah, and that points to the mutual respect with the animal. As opposed, another thing that she pointed out was that whereas often a rancher's attitude will be, I'm going to make you do this, she would say, I'm going to create the conditions so that you want to do this.
Which makes it a lot easier to manage an animal if they want to do it.
Yes, it does.
It reminds me a little bit of the Pirelli method of managing horses, where a gentle touch does much more than spurs.
Yeah, a lot of what Beth and her co-teacher Sandra, what they were doing was derived from natural horsemanship.
There you go. Well, you also worked with a lady named Natalie Topa, who is working with the Danish Refugee Council in Africa. And Natalie came up with some very interesting comments as well. So we'll move on to Africa here. In The Reindeer Chronicles by Judith Schwartz. Okay. More than half the farmers in the world are women, often with babies strapped on their backs.
Right. So this, again, is part of, just is busting that myth that when people think of farmers, they have a certain image of a lot of land and maybe a man or men kind of being in control of that land and, in essence, kind of telling that land what to do, whereas I think I've heard a figure of something like 70% of the food consumed around the world is produced by smallholder farms, mostly women, on really, really small bits of land, but working with diverse native plants to feed their families.
And often with babies on their backs.
That's right. Yeah.
In researching Metro Farm, my book Metro Farm, that's what the United Nations Development Program pointed out often, that most all of the world's food is produced on small parcels of land close to the city, and most often by women working on those farms, while men had government jobs or city jobs doing something else. But really, the big productivity of the world's food is coming from women on the farms.
Right, and Natalie pointed out, I mean, she does extraordinary work. I mean, it's just amazing. So her mission really is, so she works with displaced people and refugees, you know, internally displaced in something like 8 or 9 countries and in East Africa and Yemen. I mean, that's a whole lot of, that's a huge swath of population right there. But she really works to empower women of very, very limited resources to be able to feed their families. So she talks about being the capacity to grow food is really a bank that you can not only grow enough for yourself, but then you can sell a little bit to get school fees for your children or something like that. And she's able to really simplify how you do this in different landscapes, really challenging landscapes. Just about the men and the women in farms, in growing food in these areas, in her observation, she said that the women were focused on growing nutritious food for and medicines for their communities. Whereas she said that when men were involved in farming, it was often for profit, but often that involved cutting down trees that actually were important to the community, you know, just kind of getting involved in this large industrial system, even if on a small scale, that was in some ways depleting the resources of the community.
Kind of taking without giving.
Yeah, well, that's the model that people all over the world are shown, and to a large extent, that is kind of presented as success.
Women need different plants at different times for different purposes. The 3 P's.
Right. Yeah. And that's a lot of local knowledge that Natalie encourages people to preserve from, these refugees preserve from where they've been and to adopt where they are now.
And then finally, land degradation strains families in many ways, including provoking crisis of masculinity.
Yeah, this was really interesting because being on this side of the world, I'm not immediately, you know, exposed to these things. But what happens is that people have pride. Men and women both have pride in being able to support their families. And when the land degrades and the same amount of money, you're not earning as much money, that's one thing. And then in certain circumstances, like when there are floods, and then you might have to go further afield to buy what you need, so your money doesn't go as far. When men find this, it is shameful to them. And as Natalie pointed out, sometimes this manifests in domestic violence.
And there you are. It's what happens when you take without giving. Sooner or later, the costs come due. And there you are. So you've looked at this for quite a while, and surely you must have some conclusions. Now, you kind of remind me, and the people that you're working with remind me very much of a Cub Scout leader I had when I was a wee tyke growing up in Montana. And he took us tenderfeet on a camp out up in the mountains. And it was, kids raising hell, having the best time in the world, being away from the parents and out in the woods. And Sunday morning, we were languishing about, getting ready to pack up the camp, and a big storm rolled in, and these towering clouds rolled over us, and everything got real dark and started snowing. So us kids started running for the cars, and the scoutmaster said, "Just a minute, you get back here." And he made us prepare the camp for whoever was going to come next. And we got into that. It was a lot of fun. And I remember it to this day, cleaning out the fire pits and hunting down firewood and stacking it up and sweeping up all of the debris. And as we were marching out to the car, I looked back over my shoulder, and the great big huge giant snowflakes were falling into this campground. But it looked so inviting. And I still think of that, you know.
How wonderful.
In troubled times, I see that campground, and I think there's a good place someplace, you know, and I had something to do with it. And is that not where you're going with this?
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is how we operate on our landscapes and in our lives. We can create scarcity, or we can create abundance. It's really a choice.
And there it is. That from The Reindeer Chronicles by Judith Schwartz. Judith, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Chain today.
Well, my pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.